This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Now ready for departure.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato, and I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you on March 4th, 2010, and on the line with us again is our good friend Albert Lanier, on the line from Honolulu. Thanks for coming back, man.
Well, thank you for having me once again here on Media Monarchy. And it's nice to be back here, and it's nice to talk to you once again, James.
Absolutely. So we definitely want to tell folks that this is actually the third time you and I have talked, and so in the show notes we'll have the links back to those previous interviews where the first time we talked about the crisis in journalism, and then the second time we talked about conspiracies and secret societies in mainstream films. And we do want to make the mention, too, that you are a film critic. And maybe a brief mention on some of the things recently going on. We, of course, have the Oscars coming up in just a couple of days from now. Any thoughts or maybe any follow-up on our conspiracy film talk?
I actually have pitched the idea for that to a publisher. I haven't gotten any formal response yet, so I'm waiting to hear back from that, whether that will pan out. And in regards to the Oscars, it's an interesting Oscars this year because of some of the films. One of the more talked about films, nauseatingly so, is Avatar, which is directed by James Cameron. But another film that we were discussing this before we did. We went on the air, so to speak, is The Hurt Locker, the Catherine Bigelow film. I know that you're a big fan of that movie. And that's interesting. That, of course, is dealing with soldiers in Iraq.
And I think typically, historically, movies about wars we're currently in don't bode well during awards time, but...
Right. But you never know. Some war films do well. Like, for example, probably wars in the past. For example, Patton won the Oscar with George C. Scott. He also won an Oscar for Best Actor. Some war films do well. But of course, there's Platoon, which is about the Vietnam War. Patton, of course, about World War II, largely. It's also about George Patton. So some war films do all right. Of course, you could argue that Patton is also more of a biopic, but it's also dealing with war. Some war films do well. Another good example is The Deer Hunter.
Okay, I was just going to mention that.
But Deer Hunter actually to me is more of a film about friendship. During war, instead of war. I've always seen the Deer Hunter as a film about friendship, and that's why it works for me. As a film exclusively about Vietnam, it has its problems. I don't really buy the fact that the Vietnamese... When I saw it, I said I couldn't buy the fact that the Vietnamese would build camps right in the middle of a stream or a river. Could easily be bombed by U.S. airplanes. That didn't work for me. But as a film about friendship, it's very powerful. So some war films or war-oriented films do well. Whether the Hurt Locker will win, I wouldn't be surprised. I would not be surprised.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen kind of the tide turning for it. And I've, there's a lot of me that wants to see it win just because I find James Cameron such kind of a smug, over-the-top guy. I would like to see a female win a directing Oscar.
Well, that's very interesting. Catherine Bigelow, of course, I believe is the director of Hurt Locker. And it would be interesting to see a female director... not too many female directors have been nominated for Oscar.
No, she's the fourth in, what, 80 years.
Yeah.
So, District 9 is actually probably my favorite movie of the last year, not having seen a ton of the films that are up for the Academy Awards this year, but District 9 just kind of had it all for me as just the way it was shot, the feeling of it. Sure, it's a science fiction film, but it feels so kind of gritty and real, the way that they shot it and used sort of a cinema verite, almost documentary style.
Right. Well, it's been an interesting year in regards to films. Some interesting content matter has come out in regards to films.
Oh, and you know, and we just had, actually, sorry to interrupt you, they finally did just release Shutter Island, which we were talking about in October because it was about to come out in October. And that film, of course, has, you know, CIA mind control storyline.
Right. Of course, he's, the DiCaprio character is, actually going to investigate what's going on at a, I think it's an insane asylum or something like that on an island. So, and that film's doing very well.
It is.
Number one film.
A lot of times you think when studios hold back on movies, it's because they think they have a stinker on their hands, but maybe in this case they knew they didn't have a, you know, wintertime prestige Academy Award, but they were ready as soon as maybe the holidays were over.
Right. It's interesting because they held off on this movie and they released it in a soft portion. I think it was released in February. That's a soft part of the year because it's basically, it's just before spring, which is what we're in now, March. So there, it's, I would call it a soft part of the soft season, which is January, February.
And I think it's also when studios are dumping their real stinkers. So Shutter Island didn't have a whole lot of real competition.
Competition. I think that was intentional. I think they decided, okay, we're going to put it on, you know, in February. We're going to put it before the first big, you know, box office season, which is spring. So I that's a very conscious decision, I think, on Paramount's part. I think Paramount is the distributor of Shutter Island.
Hmm.
So I think it's deliberate. And it seems to be doing very well right now.
All right. Well, let's actually now, since now that we've had kind of the brief movie discussion, let's actually, we'll delve into the topic at hand today. And it's something...
which deserves a film of its own, frankly.
Exactly, which, you know, we haven't seen. This is something that is very simply referred to by many as the octopus. And what this involves is the case of a freelance journalist who, at the time of his death in 1991, was researching an insidious and wide-ranging conspiracy that connects to everything from the October surprise and Iran-Contra to espionage and software and the Department of Justice and 9/11 and all of those things. But the way we want to try and approach the tentacles of this octopus is, I think, through the human angle. And basically, we're talking about a guy named Danny Casolaro.
Right. That's correct. I call this Promise Me, right? Sort of Inslaw and Danny Casolaro. That's my take. That's my my area of interest in this. A Promise, of course, is the software that was developed by a man named William Hamilton under the auspices of Inslaw.
So let's actually, well, and I was going to say, because we're going to use a lot of sort of terms and names and things that people, you know, may not wrap their head around immediately.
Right.
So when we're talking about Promise, that's the name of this software that's the Prosecutor's Management Information System.
Correct.
And it was developed by INSLAW, which is the Institute for Law and Social Research.
Correct. INSLAW, that was the original name of INSLAW. And they changed, they went from Institute for Law and Social Research to just INSLAW Inc., I believe, in about 1981. That is, of course, the name of it. Promise, of course, is a prosecutor's management information system, which is the software system that was developed by Hamilton and William Hamilton, who, from what I understand, is a former employee of the CIA and the NSA. He was an analyst with the National Security Agency, from what I understand. So that was what Danny Casolaro was initially looking into. That was the first thing he was looking into. And the reason why he was examining Promise and Inslaw was because of what happened with Promise and Inslaw. And basically what happened, I'll get into this later, because we have to first discuss Danny Casolaro himself and his death. But what happened was that he was investigating what happened with Inslaw and Promise. And what occurred in a nutshell, hard to wrap this up in a nutshell, but I'll try. what happened basically was that InSlaw was forced into bankruptcy. And the Department of Justice, with whom they had a contract with, withheld payments and tried to get their hands, basically did get their hands, on Crumbs. For their own reasons, which I will try to illuminate. So basically what happened was that the DOJ screwed InSlaw, and they tried to screw them, and basically did screw them out of Perlman.
There you go. That's a succinct way of putting it. The Department of Justice contracted the Hamiltons and InSlaw to make the Promise software. They did, and they pretty much screwed them out of it.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've read the House Judiciary Committee report. In the early 90s, the House Judiciary Committee under Congressman Jack Brooks had investigated this matter. And basically, they basically found that, I mean, that the, and they weren't the only ones. You also had a bankruptcy judge, I believe, Basin, who ruled in favor of the Hamiltons, and basically said that the, Justice Department had used, really, and basically tried to intimidate them. They used unjust means to force the Hamiltons to try to give up in, Promise, and to basically try to force them into bankruptcy. But that, of course, we will get into, I guess, a little later. The first aspect, of course, that we want to look into is the death of Danny Castellaro. So that's our first chapter, chapter one, so to speak. I've just provided the prologue, so now we can get into chapter one, I guess. The death of Danny Castellaro. Just a little bit of background on Danny Castellaro. Danny Castellaro, I believe, was born into a family of six. He's from Virginia, Fairfax County, I believe, Fairfax, Virginia. And he was basically a freelance journalist. He had attended Providence College and he dropped out. He ended up freelancing for a number of publications. I believe the National Enquirer was one publication he had written for. And he had a lot of interests. I understand he liked racing horses at some point, and he had other interests as well. But what happened is that Castellaro dropped out of journalism to kind of get into computer publications. I think he owned Computer Age, which I believe at the time was one of the few, if not the only, publication dealing with computers in the U.S. So Castellaro was basically the owner of a publication or publications. One of them was Computer Age. And I believe at one point he was basically providing most of the articles to Computer Age, or one of his publications. And he ended up selling these. I don't think he made much of a profit on the sale, but he ended up selling this. And he got back into freelance journalism. And his return to freelance journalism dealt with investigating the InSlaw case. So he was investigating what occurred with Puff. And this is what happened. You know, what was mentioned. Now, from this point onward, his investigation into the Promise affair, I like to call it Promise, but for our purposes, let's just call it Promise. The Promise software and the InSlaw and InSlaw Inc. His investigation of that led him into what he termed the octopus. Now, what is the octopus? In a nutshell, if you know what a regular octopus looks like, it has a head and has tentacles. The head of the octopus would be, from what I've read and from what I understand, to be a combination of officials, organized crime figures, and intelligence agency members and veterans. So you have these individuals, and the tentacles from the head of this octopus reach into different scandals that manifested themselves in the 1980s. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International scandal, the Iran-Contra scandal, and of course, the October Surprise scandal. The October Surprise figures into InSlaw, as I'll get into. See, I wasn't joking when I said there's a lot of loose ends. Lisa, I believe I said that.
We did, and that is what can be difficult about going into topics like this because, you know, whether we were talking about, say, just 9/11, there's all the tentacles that separate from that. If we were talking about the Franklin cover-up out of Omaha, you know, there's a whole set of tentacles there. This is a topic that it would be easy to go down different holes and perhaps lose folks. Right. So I think we, you know, we're going to try and keep it, you know, as accessible as possible. And again, we'll provide a lot of the extra links and information for folks to do the research for themselves. But please continue.
Right. I think that's very important. I, of course, have been doing research, but the internet provides the opportunity for people to look into this on their own, and they can easily do this. I would recommend making a losing your life to it, but yeah, there's a lot that people can do. I mean, one of the warnings that I stress here, and I'll stress it later, is that this subject matter is extensive. I mean, of all the things that I've done interviews about over the past God knows how many months, in the past year, I should say, this is probably one of the most extensive that I've researched in 15 years of being a journalist and writer. And, I don't even think I've hit the bottom of this, you know, vast well, or should I say series of wells. So that's a warning, and I would warn them. There's a lot to this. There's just a lot of information. So anyway, I was discussing Danny, back to chapter one. I was discussing Danny Castellaro, who is, of course, a freelance writer and journalist, or was a freelance writer and journalist. He was returning, and as I mentioned before, he had been a writer for numerous publications. He had freelanced. He was basically a college dropout. He had attended the Providence College, and he had dropped out, gotten into freelancing, got out basically to own and operate computer publications like Computer Age. He sold those off, got back into freelancing, and he was investigating Innslaw and Promise. And it was in the course of this that he developed into The Octopus, which is, as I mentioned, for lack of a better term, combines organized crime figures, intelligence veterans, and U.S. officials in something that the tentacles extend to numerous scandals like BCCI, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, Iran-Contra, and the October Surprise scandal.
So it also includes the banksters and military as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I haven't even mentioned, you know, the other things that'll probably crop up in this aspect, too. But so this is what we see in regards to the Octopus itself. And it was really his submerging into the Octopus, Castellaro's emergence into the Octopus. This is where he was about the time that he died. And he died on August 10th, 1991. Now, let's just set that up. He was working on something that he hoped would be a book. My understanding in terms of what Castellaro hoped to do is he was looking at it more from a fictional point of view. That's what I've read. It's hard, you know, it probably would have been a fictional book with a lot of real life overlays to it, a lot of factual overlays to it. I know that he wanted to write a book called Indio, and I'll get into Indio later. But in any event, Castellaro wanted to, was looking into the Octopus. And he went in about early August. We're talking the last few days of his life, so we're talking the 8th, the 9th, 10th, or, the 10th is when his body was found. But he was in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Now, you, of course, James, are from West Virginia, and so you're familiar with that area, if I'm not mistaken.
Very much so. Very much so. So I'm originally from Fayetteville, which is in the southern part of the state. and I went away to college at Shepherd College, which is now known as Shepherd University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which is just a mere 10 minutes away from Martinsburg. So now, I was still in high school in Fayetteville when Danny Casolaro was found dead in a Sheraton Hotel bathtub in 91, but I find the connections of some of the things there in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia kind of interesting that maybe we'll get into here in just a few minutes, but let's continue.
Okay. Now, Casolaro was there to meet some sources. And according to Elliot Richardson is the former attorney general under Richard Nixon. He resigned at the height of Watergate because he refused to fire the special prosecutor. And he was representing the Hamiltons. He was their attorney. And what happened is, in the early 1990s, an Australian program called The Current Affair, or Australian version of Current Affair, did a segment on Islam. And he was interviewed. He was also interviewed for Unsolved Mysteries, which at the time, which in the early 90s, was hosted by Robert Stack. Now, there's a newer version that's on Spike TV that's hosted by Dennis Farina. And that is where I first found out about this case. It was the Unsolved Mysteries segment. This is the early 90s. So, Elliot Richardson was interviewed for not only the Australian Current Affair, but also for Unsolved Mysteries. And in the Current Affair, he stated that Casolaro supposedly had it. And his friends, Casolaro's friends, say that he was close to breaking the story, meaning I was supposed to be octopus, but also probably related to the Innslaw case itself. So he was there in Martinsburg for a very specific reason, and I want people to note that because of what happened, you know, after his body was found, or how his death was classified. That's very important to know. Now, here's an interesting thing. Actually, I'll get into the last days, I should say. So, my understanding from Casolaro's last days, at least from what I've read, is that he had... One account that I had read is that he had, I believe, on the 9th, on August 9th, had been meeting with or was with an individual described by a waitress. He was at a cocktail lounge, I believe, at the hotel. And someone asked, quote, Arab or Iranian? Now, I can't go too far about that. I don't have anything beyond what I've been able to, you know, read about that. Now, another aspect that he was, I think, also, if I'm not mistaken, he had also met William Richard Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'd given him some documents. And that was before. So what happened is that Casolaro's body was found on August 10th. That's a Saturday. It was found at, I believe, 12:30 p.m. Now, when Casolaro was found, he was found in room 517 of the Sheraton, I think Martinsburg Inn, I think that's the formal name of it. His body was found in the bathroom. Now, it was a tub that was basically a blood, you know, blood, bloody water. But he's found in a tub of bloody water. There supposedly was not only blood on the floor, which is a tile floor, but also on the wall. The reason why I point this out is that Casolaro's friends and family say that he was squeamish about blood. He didn't even want to get a blood test. He was supposed to get a blood test for which escapes my mind at that point. But he was supposed to get a blood test. He was very squeamish about blood and about blood tests. I think even his brother, Tony, has said this. His brother is a physician. Casolaro's dad was also a doctor. He was an obstetrician, from what I understand.
So they would probably know if he was squeamish about blood.
That's one of the strongest things from everything that I've read, even from the profiles on Unsolved Mysteries. People can check out online. and The Current Affair, which is also online. People can go to YouTube and check those out. And I recommend they do. That's one of the strongest things that emerge is in terms of the details of Cafallero's life, is that he was squeamish about blood. So, you have a man in a blood-filled tub of water, blood on the floor and blood on the wall. My understanding is there were also bloody towels that were on the floor. Those were later disposed of, from what I understand. So, Cafallero's body was discovered, I believe, by a maid at the hotel. She called, I think, a maintenance man, and he looked into it, and then they called the police. And they came in. Now, Cafallero's body had about 12 cuts. Or should I say, his arms had 12 cuts. Not his wrist, his arm. I believe there was 8. Let me see here. I think you had 8 on one arm and you had about 4 on the other. At least one of the cuts sliced into the tendon. That means that it went beyond the skin, you know, tendons over the bone, right? So if it sliced beneath the skin and into the tendon, it's a strong cut. So
basically, how would someone that squeamish slash the hell out of themselves so deep they're cutting tendons, you know, right, a dozen times?
Interesting detail number one. Why would somebody who's afraid of blood tests, as you mentioned, squeamish, why would they cut themselves? Why would they commit suicide in such a manner? To me, this is one of the first details, or I call it interesting details, of this case that don't quite jive.
Well, I was going to say there's also, so you mentioned the towels that almost looked as though someone had kind of, you know how you throw a towel down and use your foot to wipe something up, as if something had been moved around.
Right.
So basically the murder scene is completely suspicious.
Well, the official, remember what the police in Martinsburg classified it as, a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
which sounds like something out of Arkansas, where folks die of, you know, laying on train tracks, and it's, you know, ruled suicide.
That's a whole other case. I'm familiar with that case. That's a whole other case. But in this case, that's why I mentioned the blood. You have this blood, from what I've read, you had blood, not only bloody water in the tub, but on the floor, the wall. Again, the interesting detail, all these cuts. That's just, so we've got those details. Now then, here's another aspect. The body was found, obviously the police came, they took it away. The body was, I believe, looked over, examined. What happened is the body ended up being embalmed. Now, the body's found on a Saturday. The relatives of Danny Cafallero are informed on Monday. So nearly a couple of days go by. By this time, Danny Casalero's body, which was, I believe, sent to the Brown Funeral Home in Martinsburg, was embalmed, I believe. So it was embalmed at the Brown Funeral Home. Now here's interesting detail number two. Why is it that a body, which has just recently been not only discovered, but removed from the site of death, supposedly, why would it then be embalmed in less than a couple of days? I mean, this is a violation of West Virginia law. If this was supposedly your average suicide or your average death in a place like Martinsburg or any other place, why would you wait? Why would you rush to embalm? Why would you rush to even mess with the body and preserve it in that sort of state? Why would there be a need for that? The family didn't get permission. In fact, they weren't even notified until Monday. By that time, he'd already been involved.
Mm-hmm. And the family, again, has said they found it incomprehensible that he would kill himself this way because he was squeamish.
Right.
And it's this then sounds like cleaning up a crime scene illegally.
Right. See, that's the issue. Here's another point. There was a professional cleaning crew, from what I understand, that went into the hotel and cleaned that room. In the meantime, all of these potential clues, the clues that would lead to suicide or lead to murder, however you want to look at it, they were tossed out, thrown out in the course of this cleaning. They went through the room, they cleaned it. I think John Connolly had mentioned on the original Unsolved Mysteries segment that, and I had read his Spy Magazine investigation into the death of Danny Casolaro, that they had not used a strainer, I believe, to drain the water. When you look at the details of this, it's simply just surprising. And then, I haven't even mentioned the so-called suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Let me see. Now, the so-called suicide note, he had basically, there was a page ripped out of a notepad. And this is what it read, at least I can read my notes here. To those who I love the most, please forgive me for the worst possible thing I could have done. Most of all, sorry to my son. I know deep down that God will let me in. Now, my understanding is that Casolaro was not religious, and that his style of writing was a bit more on the flowery or wordy side.
Friends have actually described him. He wasn't an investigative journalist. Gainey was a poet. And so this last note is very flat and very religious. Yeah, and that last line is, I know deep down inside that God will let me in.
Yes, I know deep down inside that God will let me in. Yeah, interesting detail number three. At least for me. So we have 10 to 12 cuts on his arm, at least one that could sever a tendon. We have the fact that his body was embalmed after it was removed and before his family was notified. And we have his suicide note, which as you clearly state, is written in a kind of flat tone, not befitting someone who was had far more literary aspirations, obviously, as a writer, than this would imply, and who was supposedly not religious, at least from what I've read. All of this seems to indicate that things are not what they seem, to put it mildly, in this case. And then you have the autopsy, which I believe was performed at the University of Virginia, and in the autopsy, my understanding is that I think there was a little alcohol that was found, but you also had antidepressants in Casolaro's system. Now, my understanding is that he had no prescription for these antidepressants. There hasn't been any evidence that I'm aware of. Nothing's turned up that implies that he was, you know, taking this on prescription. Also in the autopsy, there was a bruise on his head, and I believe there was also a bruise on his arm. And I also understand that his nails were possibly broken, and according to the Unsolved Mysteries segment, the original one, the tops of his, fingers, were gone. Tops of at least three fingers on one hand were gone. So like the very, very top, tip top of his fingers, I gather, were gone. So, my understanding is that his nails were not examined, looked at for tissue that would indicate whether he had fought anyone or grabbed any skin underneath, because if you fight someone, perhaps if you get a good grab, if there was struggle, they'd grab some skin. Right? Nothing like that. Also, he had, so that's another, you could call it interesting detail number four, or details number four. Also, the fact that he had supposedly symptoms of multiple sclerosis. And this is seen as a reason for his suicide. Now, it's a plausible reason. I'll grant that. It's a plausible reason. But there's no indication that he exhibited any symptoms of MS, at least at the time that he was alive. And I guess I would call this, it would be, what, interesting detail number five? Do I have to find now?
Mm-hmm.
So, here we have the death of Danny Cancellaro, and I've just mentioned the details. Right?
Well, and I was going to say that we've kind of discussed all the interesting things that were found at the scene, but maybe let's move to what wasn't found at the scene.
Right. His notes. His papers. Supposedly, I think he had packed up a black bag, and the black bag had a lot of his notes and his papers. All the notes and papers that he had brought with him to the hotel. That dealt with the octopus, that dealt perhaps maybe with Inns Law or various aspects of Inns Law, they were gone. They weren't there in the hotel. And certainly the police said that they didn't know anything about any such papers. They didn't recover any. They weren't there, according to the police. So that's also very significant. That's another very significant detail. His papers were gone. So that begs the question, you know, obviously, who took them? We don't know. So when you add up all of these factors, it results in a very strange occurrence, to put it mildly. This is very strange.
We also have some of the connections of, and again, this is, you know, what's so fascinating about this is that there's a lot of open source information about this story, and we, I don't know if we mentioned it on mic or not, about there was a Wired story many, many years ago, I believe called the Inns Law Octopus.
There's, which I've read, yes.
Pieces from the Village Voice and the book put out by Feral House, which actually I'm holding right here, by Ken Thomas and Jim Keith. Jim Keith, of course, someone else who died under mysterious circumstances. So all of this info is really, you know, is available. And again, the links will be provided. We even have the mention of something about a mysterious sort of military officer showing up to Cancellaro's funeral a few days later.
And you can find this on the Unsolved Mysteries original segment, Unsolved Mysteries, was originally hosted by Robert Stack, film and TV actor.
Mm-hmm.
Those of you who've seen Airplane will probably know he starred in that movie, the parody movie. But he was the host for many years. And this is the Danny Cancellaro segment that appeared there shows a recreation of a military officer. Somebody was wearing, I guess it would be, you know, with ribbons and everything, walking up. This was during Cancellaro's funeral, walking up, putting a ribbon on, I believe, his grave, on his coffin,
mm-hmm.
saluting, and then heading back to his car. No one, according to that segment, that Unsolved Mystery segment, as reported on Unsolved Mysteries, no one in the family knew who this was.
Mm-hmm. And that sources back to this Village Voice article.
Right.
So,
yeah,
so
that
what
the
I'm
one
saying
written
is
by James Ridgway?
And Vaughn. Yes.
Yes.
Ridgway,
yes,
and Vaughn
read,
article.
Yeah, I've read portions of that. So when you add up all these details, I call them interesting details. The conclusion that you, at least that any reasonable or sane person, and it's easy to get insane in this whole affair, that the only conclusion that you have to come up with that something isn't right about this. Now, here's my take on it. I've laid out the details, and James, of course, has also laid out the details. We've both done it. here's my take on this. Now, those who argue that this was a suicide, I would argue was not. I think it's unlikely that Danny Casolaro decided to head down to Martinsburg, West Virginia, of all places, to go to a hotel room, take a razor blade, or whatever kind of blade was used, cut his arm more than 10 times or more, including cutting down into the tendon, and then allow the blood to flow into a tub in which he was sitting into. Another aspect about Casolaro is he was rather wary about being naked. Obviously, he was in a bathtub, so that's a different story. It's intimate. But he was worried about being naked as well around people. Very interesting. That's kind of a minor interesting detail, but it's interesting nonetheless. So is it logical for a guy who's so afraid of blood to do this and to go down to Martinsburg, West Virginia? Now, this is what I understand about Martinsburg, West Virginia, and you can bring up some more facts. I'd like to get your perspective on this, Jamie. Martinsburg, West Virginia has several federal facilities, or facilities relating to agencies of the federal government, like the U.S. Coast Guard, and, of course, the IRS. The IRS has a computing center at Martinsburg, West Virginia. This computing center deals with tax forms relating to businesses and also individuals. But I think businesses are a large part of it. It's no coincidence that Danny Casolaro went to Martinsburg, West Virginia. And if he were going to commit suicide, why couldn't he have done it in Fairfax, Virginia, or anywhere else? Why would he have to go here to commit suicide? It doesn't add up. It does not add up.
And I think we should mention, too, that before he left for Martinsburg, I believe he told someone, you know, I'm going to bring back the head of the octopus, that he felt like the research was coming together, and he was right. Going to Martinsburg to get some final piece, he believed. So why would he say, yeah, you know, my work is going great, and I'm about to, you know, pull it off.
Right.
And he also told his family, you know, if I die under mysterious circumstances, don't believe it was an accident or suicide.
Right. That's very important because he's basically stating something could happen to me. He knows that there have been deaths associated with not only the octopus, but with Inslaw, with the Perlman scandal.
And he was getting threatening, harassing phone calls leading up to that time.
Right. That's the indication. That's what his brother has stated, that he was getting threats from people he didn't know, calling him up and saying that he's going to die. So he clearly knew that there was, my feeling is that Casolaro knew there was danger in going to Martinsburg, West Virginia. And I stress this part about Martinsburg, West Virginia, IRS facility that's there, computing center. I would assume this computing center has been there for quite some time. It was there when Casolaro had gone to Martinsburg, West Virginia. If that's the case, now, here's another interesting aspect, and this is why I'm looking at the IRS. And I believe the IRS, maybe not directly, but the IRS in some way figures into his death. You have the IRS center there, the computing center at Martinsburg, West Virginia. Michael Reconosciuto, who was the source for Danny Casolaro, said on the Unsolved Mysteries segment back in the early 90s that Casolaro had a source in the IRS that was providing him with hard copy printups of individuals he's looking at. Targets is the word that Casolaro used. When I look at the fact that Martinsburg has this data center or this computer center, when I look at what Reconosciuto said, and you can't take everything that Michael Reconosciuto says totally and believe it totally, because I, you know, didn't have any interest in it at first. But then when I, you know, read about Martinsburg, read about this computing center, and I also go back to the fact, and I'm spilling a little beans here about the Promise case, I maybe shouldn't until I get into foreground here, the fact that that one of the procurement officers, a Vidniak, was a former IRS agent. Now, this is the procurement officer for the Department of Justice who was dealing with the contract between Promise, between Inslaw and the Department of Justice. Now, this was the contract, the initial contract, to supply Promise to the U.S. Attorney's offices, basically for the Justice Department. So Vidniak, who was the procurement officer for the Justice Department at the time, he was a former IRS agent. He was a revenue agent for the IRS. So when I look at all of these aspects, now again,
we've just kind of introduced a couple new characters there with Michael Riconosciuto,
right,
and also Vidniak, and what's the first name?
Let me see if I have the first name here. I've got my notes right in front of me. Peter Vidniak, I believe is his name.
Peter Vidniak.
Yeah. He's kind of bounced around. Well, like I said, I'll get a little into him.
Mm-hmm.
But, so that's the connection that that's what interests me about this. And I don't know who's written about this thus far, who's looked into it. But the IRS aspect is interesting to me.
Well, and what I'll then say, I never lived in Martinsburg, which is
right
in Berkeley County in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. But I went to school in Shepherdstown at Shepherd University for 10 years. I lived there from 95 to 2005. Shepherdstown is in Jefferson County, but again, 10 minutes away from Martinsburg. What started to dawn on me, and this was just right around the turn of the millennium, the first week of 2000, Shepherdstown and Shepherd University specifically hosted Israeli-Syrian peace talks with Bill Clinton. And so it brought this amazing event to our little small town, and there were stories of, Israeli agents driving around with jamming equipment so that, the Syrians, couldn't communicate as well, just to kind of screw up the process. And there was one night I know I was closing down at the movie theater, appropriately enough, that I worked at. And, locking the door and looking overhead and seeing this big helicopter fly over and, there goes the president. So when an event like that came to Shepherdstown, it really started to make me think, why would they do it here? Of course, the obvious reason is, it's an hour away from D.C., so it's just enough away, but still close that it's not a big, huge travel. They can get back to D.C. and with the quickness, on helicopters and things. But the facilities that housed these peace talks had only recently been built, and a lot of this took place in something called the Clarion Inn, which, is a part, I believe, of just sort of the franchise of, Comfort Inn and Clarion Inn and Sleep Inn. But a lot of those places are sort of, independently owned, franchises. This place had been built just outside of the town limits in Shepherdstown, and it really kind of, I guess, piqued my curiosity when these peace talks came to this facility that had just been built as, as a hotel for the public. But, going by, friends that have worked there and do work there, there are places that you can't go and you're not allowed to go. And they'll sometimes host sort of, military meetings and things, And what really got me thinking about it was, I don't know if you're familiar with the Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia.
Sounds familiar.
In
that
Lewisburg, it was basically a Cold War era bunker. It was a sort of, it was the West Virginia White House, basically. So if something would happen in D.C., this was their continuity of government, one of their underground structures. So as the Cold War wore on and, the place basically got to the point where if something happened, it couldn't have really facilitated, a new secret government. And a Washington Post, I think some journalists there, basically were going to blow the whole story. And they basically, I think before they ran the story, went to the Greenbrier and said, hey, we're about to blow you guys out of the water and put it on the front of the magazine. So we're telling you now to give you the chance to come out and say, yes, the Greenbrier Hotel has been a Cold War bunker all these years, but now it's not anymore. And you can go and it's a museum and you can tour through it and things. But the connections that started to come in Shepherdstown, and I feel like after those peace talks happened in 2000, a lot of other government facilities, there's a Fish and Wildlife Center, that's called the NCTC, which is funny because it's the National Conservation Training Center, but one of the other alphabet agencies, NCTC, is the National Counterterrorism Center. And all of these places just started to spring up that, again, I think there is and has been a big kind of spook infestation into Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
I'm not really surprised. This is fascinating to me. This is interesting. When I read about Martinsburg, I read about the IRS Center. I heard what Reconosciuto had to say. And, you know, you've got to take what he says. With characters like that, you have to say that half of what he's saying is probably true and half of it is probably untrue. And then when I look at the fact that this procurement officer for the Department of Justice, which was working on this contract between DOJ, Justice Department, and Inslaw, was a former IRS agent. The IRS, I think there's a definite IRS connection. Now again, I'm not saying the IRS, is necessarily insinuated into the octopus.
No, and I think like a lot of the things in, quote-unquote conspiracy research, we're not saying the IRS is in on it. My aunt that works for the IRS isn't a part of this scheme. I think like a lot of the other elements, and what we're even talking about the octopus, is that you have rogue elements within banking and military and politics and government.
Right.
Rogue elements who, owe no allegiance to no country or no religion. They are families. They're essentially gangsters, and I've called them multi-generational serial killers. These are the families in the organization. So again, it's not, it's not your uncle that works for the IRS that's in on it.
But what's interesting to me, of course, is the fact, if Reconosciuto is true about what he says, and that he did have a source in the IRS, it would make a lot of sense for him to be in Martinsburg if this facility was open at the time. If this facility was open, mm-hmm. The computing center was there at the time.
There's also now there's a biometrics, a sort of forensics lab that is in West Virginia, one of the kind of the leaders in biometrics. So West Virginia, and that's what I've always found fascinating. I was born and raised there. Is that on the one hand, it's a completely unknown state. So there are times, when I mention that I'm from West Virginia while here in Oregon, you get the response of, oh, I know some people in Roanoke. Like, that's Virginia,
Virginia.
But when you start to delve into it, you do find all these amazing we're not going to go there, but you have the
right.
Sort of Mothman connections and Charles Manson and the, Moundsville and the penitentiaries and all of those things that, again, I think, later when I have more time, I do want to go into sort of the alternative history and conspiracies surrounding West Virginia. But please continue.
Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting. As I don't recall if I mentioned this at the beginning, but I believe I did. But my view of the whole Inslaw and Promise scandals relates to what I call the secret history of the United States, which is a history we don't see in textbooks and we don't see on TV and we don't see in movies. But I think that Inslaw and Promise is part of what I call the spy. Promise is part of what I call the spy state. And by spy state, what I mean is the national security framework, the intelligence infrastructure that has been built since the post-war period with the formation of the Alphabet Intelligence Agency or Alphabet agencies like the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, and so on and so forth.
All those things that spilled out of the National Security Act of 1947. Yeah.
Right. Precisely. So why is, I'll get into this, I guess we should wrap up the Dana Castellaro podcast,
mm-hmm.
But what I'll get into is my belief is, and this is what I'm saying in terms of my thesis, my belief is that Promise is part of what I call the spy state, which is this intelligence apparatus. And so what it is it's a vital component, so like the second wave, because Promise, I believe, was very important. It was important enough for the DOJ to want to ruin Inslaw. It was important enough for them to basically pirate the software.
So
it was
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was going to say, so if we basically have an investigative journalist close, or at least he believed close to wrapping up this investigation, but winds up suspiciously dead, chasing after something that, again, with all its connections to banking and military and all that, comes down to basically a piece of software called Promise. So let's talk maybe about what this software was and is.
Well, Promise, as you mentioned before, is Prosecutor's Management Information System. Now, according to the House Judiciary Committee's report on the Inflaw hearings, this is, for those who want to look it up, it's report 102-857, the 102nd Congress, second session. And this is a quote from the report. Promise was, quote, designed to meet the criminal prosecutor workloads of large urban jurisdictions. Now, why is Promise so fascinating or so interesting or so important?
Because that description sounds pretty boring.
Yeah, it sounds bland. Yeah, you're right. It does seem bland. Now, in looking at James Ridgway's article, I think it's the, I think it's article for, it was Village Voice, I believe.
If there's the James Ridgway and Doug Vaughn article called The Last Days of Danny Casolaro that was published in the Village Voice, October 15th, 1991.
Correct. Now, I think he also wrote, I don't know if he also wrote another article on the Inflaw software scam or scandal. Now, what Inflaw is interesting in that it not only basically, as I mentioned, what Inflaw could do was it could keep track of cases, it could keep track of defendants, it could keep track of attorneys. Not only that, but my understanding is it could follow the history of an investigation, according to James Ridgway, a history down to the most recent police report, or detective's most recent report. So this software system was a bit of a breakthrough, I would say. Now, Promise, and this has to be really, I want to make sure that I emphasize this to people. What do I mean by Promise? There are actually two versions of Promise. The first version was developed by, as I mentioned, William Hamilton. And as we had mentioned before, his company, it was a non-profit company, or a non-profit organization called the Institute for Law and Social Research. And this was founded in the early 70s, 1974, if I'm not mistaken. Now, basically, they developed Promise, however you want to state it, a Promise, due to grants from the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. Now, was an agency within the Justice Department. It's no longer around. So the federal government provided the seed money, the funding to create Promise, to basically fund Promise. Basically, it came from the federal government. So what happened is, by 1981, the LEAA was eliminated. So what happened is that Hamilton and his wife Nancy, they decided to turn Inflaw into a for-profit company. So it went from not-for-profit to for-profit in 1981 or so. And the express purpose, of course, was to market Promise, or Promise, and its subsidiary software programs. So that was the main function. Now, I mentioned before that there is, that Promise was developed by the LEAA, was developed under funding from the LEAA, which was an agency of the Department of Justice, or Justice Department. Basically, it was funded by the federal government. What happened is that Hamilton came out with another version, which is known in the Judiciary Committee report and elsewhere as Enhanced Promise, or Promise 82. For our purposes, why don't we just call this Promise 2.0, and the original will be Promise 1.0. Hopefully that'll make it a lot simpler. So, Hamilton develops Promise 2.0. And this is the, and so the Justice Department wants this version. This is the version that they basically tried to destroy INSLAW over. It was PROMIS 2.0 or Enhanced PROMIS. So, what happened is that the Justice Department and INSLAW conclude a contract. This contract was worth about $10 million. I've seen some sources to be 9.6, but generally I'll go with 10 because that was in the Congressional Committee report. And this was a 3-year contract. And this would basically have PROMIS installed at a number of U.S. attorneys' offices. Now, before the LEAA was dismantled or eliminated, PROMIS was at a couple of U.S. attorneys' offices. So it was already up and running. So it was basically on a pilot or test basis, and it was being used and run. Now, what happened was, in 1983, the contract was modified. So in 1982, March of 1982, Justice Department awards INSLAW the contract. 1983, the contract modified. And what happens is the Justice Department agrees to pay pay licensing fees to INSLAW because they admit that they have those rights basically. So that's a part of what you see with software programs. You have to pay licensing fees for the software program. What happens though is that afterwards, Justice withholds payments from INSLAW. Now, INSLAW tried, to resolve the matter, try to negotiate. Justice didn't want to negotiate. They stonewalled. So by February 1985, INSLAW was forced to go into bankruptcy. Now, my understanding is that the Justice Department withheld about $1.6 million. That's a figure that keeps cropping up. Well, at least it was over $1 million. Let's just agree to that. So, INSLAW is forced into bankruptcy by 1985. But they didn't just want INSLAW to go into bankruptcy. They wanted them eliminated. Basically, what they want is INSLAW to go from Chapter 11 bankruptcy to Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Chapter 11 is reorganization. The common bankruptcy that most people have heard about or they know. It basically allows a company or an entity to basically organize themselves fiscally in regards to dealing with their debts, expenditures, all kinds of outstanding monies or financial issues that they have. And of course the assets contained therein. Chapter 7 is liquidation. That basically means that it's turned over to a trustee. That trustee basically decides if your company is going to remain open for any amount of time, but it means that all your assets, most of your major assets, or basically all your assets, basically get liquidated. They basically get put up for sale, or auction.
Just so you can try and basically break even, but so you can settle all your outstanding debts. But it kills the company.
Right, it does. See, if they forced INSLAW to Chapter 7 bankruptcy, what does that mean?
They don't even exist anymore.
Correct. But more importantly,
well,
PROMIS gets sold. See, that's what they wanted. They wanted enhanced PROMIS. Now here's the weird part. Now here's the interesting part. The PROMIS 2.0 was actually, there was a firm that was interested in buying this PROMIS 2.0. The firm is Hadron Incorporated. Hadron Incorporated is controlled by Biotech Capital Corporation, which is also known as Infotech, I think is another name for it, Infotech. And that was, that had as its president and chair a man by the name of Dr. Earl Bryan. Now who's Earl Bryan? Dr. Earl Bryan was a combat surgeon in Vietnam. He served in Vietnam. My understanding is he may have been involved in aspects of Operation Phoenix, or at least tied to a unit that dealt with it. I'm not quite sure. That's one aspect.
Operation Phoenix being an assassination program in Vietnam War.
Precisely. So Brian was involved in Hadron Incorporated. Obviously, that was his company, through Biotech Capital Corporation, or Infotech. Now, Brian had served in the Reagan administration in California when Ronald Reagan was governor in, the late 60s, in the 60s or so, getting into 70s. So he was part of the Reagan administration in California. Now, he had served in a, he was the Secretary of Health and Welfare under that administration. And he quit to run for senator, I believe, against Alan Cranston, but he lost. So when Reagan got to the White House, he was on the task force for health care reduction. It was kind of an unpaid gig for him. Now, Earl Brian figures into this. And any, like, for example, if you're taking a look at the Australian A Current Affair segment, you'll find Brian's name up there. You'll see a picture of Earl Brian. The reason why he's involved in this whole affair is not only because Hadron Incorporated was involved in trying to buy the software, but because Earl Brian himself has ties to Republican players. Ronald Reagan is one. Another is Ed Meese, who was Attorney General under Ronald Reagan. In fact, I believe Meese's wife had some interest in Hadron or some of Brian's company. Now, Brian himself, it's interesting because he, from what I've read, Brian himself was involved in some other stolen materials, tapes that involved the names of people on welfare in California, I believe. Now, Earl Brian, his name, according to those who've written extensively about the, not only the Octopus, but about the Enslaw affair, Brian himself is tied to the October surprise scandal. And the belief is, this is the belief as brought out by numerous writers, the belief is that Earl Brian was involved in helping to broker the deals that allowed the October surprise scandal, or basically October surprise, for those who aren't aware of it. That basically involved members of the then Reagan, Ronald Reagan campaign, who was supposedly meeting in secret with Iranian officials. And the intent of this was to make sure that the hostages that were held by Iran, Iran had stormed the U.S. embassy in the late 70s. This is when the Shah of Iran was ousted by Islamists, or basically elements that were loyal to the religious leader, Ayatollah Khomeini.
Mm-hmm. And of course, all the other intelligence connections that has on its own.
Oh, jeez. So they took over the U.S. embassy. A bunch of students rushed over the walls of the U.S. embassy, basically took hostages, the remaining members of the U.S. embassy there in Iran. And these hostages were held for a number of months, like over a year. And basically what the Reagan campaign team, if it is believed, in regards to the whole thing, supposedly what these officials from the Reagan campaign, in terms of meeting with the Iranian officials, were ironing out, was a deal that would keep the hostages back in Iran, kept them held until the Reagan campaign won the 1980 election. And after that election, the hostages would be released.
Mm-hmm. So that in this campaign in 1980, so we're talking about, and that's why it's called the October Surprise, because it's right before the November election in 1980, Jimmy Carter was weak and looked even weaker because he couldn't get these hostages out of Iran. The Reagan team was saying, we're tough, we'll get those hostages back. Meanwhile, they were wheeling and dealing to make sure the hostages didn't come out before the election, thereby helping Jimmy Carter, because he would have been able to claim sort of victory there.
Right, absolutely. And the whole point, the reason why it's called October Surprise, was the fear that if Carter was able to negotiate passage for the hostages out of Iran, and if he was able to get them released, that it would prove to be the surprise for the Reagan campaign. That he would engineer a way to get the hostages out, and that would improve his standings in the polls and lead to him being reelected.
Mm-hmm. And
so that
now,
was the fear.
And the term October Surprise has now come to mean sort of any kind of shady game changer in the days leading up to a presidential election.
Right, right. Now, according to... Now, the October Surprise is not considered to be an official scandal. That is not considered official. So I have to emphasize that. October Surprise is considered to be a discredited account, supposedly. Even though, of all the supposed conspiracies that are out there, this is one of the most logical ones that there is. It makes absolute sense. And we know that in 1968, that Richard Nixon told South Vietnamese officials, or tried to get South Vietnamese officials to hold off on peace talks with the North Vietnamese in order to get a better deal from Nixon, who was then running for president against Hubert Humphrey. So we know that that occurred.
Mm-hmm. So again, that we've seen it throughout history, so why
right.
have
so
we
why
not?
Is it feasible that October Surprise could happen? But that's, you know, that's as it is.
So,
you know,
if we can maybe jump back to the enhanced right. promise, the new
right.
and updated version, what did this new updated version have, and what makes this so powerful?
It's interesting. Now, my understanding from what I've read is that the American and the British navies were conducting tests on software, on any software programs or any types of computer programs that could track Soviet subs. This was, I think, in about 1983 or something. It was in the early 80s. And they were using various types of programs, and they used PROMIS. And when they used PROMIS, or PROMIS, as some would call it, PROMIS worked. So that gets into a little into the intelligence community. You argue what was so good about it. Well, this is where Michael Reconosciuto comes in. Now, I mentioned him before. Michael Reconosciuto was called by the committee, the Judiciary Committee, a shady character. They use that exact quote. The last I heard of Reconosciuto, he was in jail. He was in prison on drug charges in Seattle. Or Washington State. Reconosciuto was a source of Cancelero. And basically, Reconosciuto has said that he took the PROMIS software and he installed a backdoor. This backdoor would basically allow any party or entity that had the right access code to read any of the software that this system was on. So the other software, all the other facets of the computer system that PROMIS was entered on, it could read that. What does this mean? It means essentially that this can be used as, in essence, a bug. Some people use the term Trojan horse. I like the term bug. When you bug a house or you bug a room, what are you doing? You're putting a tiny electronic microphone and receiver for sound into a lampshade or any other part, and you're listening to conversations. In the case of PROMIS, with this backdoor that Reconosciuto says he installed in the software, this would allow any agency or any party access to whatever is on their operating systems, on their software, what have you. So you're talking about in the early 80s, this is like a license to spy. That's why I think mm-hmm. that PROMIS is important when we talk about the spy state that the U.S. has become.
It will, and I think we'll probably get to that as it extrapolates out wider and wider. So we're talking about basically cutting edge, amazing software that gave people real-time overviews of attorneys and police administrations and other just government agencies, non-governmental agencies, you could sell this as a great thing to these people that they wanted this amazing software, but it came with a backdoor that let the information leak out, essentially, or that gave the spooks the access.
Right. You could read it when you had the right access code. You could get into this trapdoor and you could read whatever information was there. And Bill Hamilton said on the Australian Current Affairs segment that was done in the 1990s, he mentioned in this interview that what Promise did was it categorized, it was equivalent to, with the backdoor, was equivalent to reading handwritten notes or written notes. The difference is, with Promise, you could categorize and index these. So it's kind of neat and organized. Another interesting aspect of the Promise software. So clearly, this software was seen as beyond beneficial.
And it was, like I said, basically used to spy on the good guys and the bad guys, or whoever the gray area in between is.
Correct. That's what we're getting into here. See, this is why the Department of Justice was so interested in this. Now, Reconosciuto says that he was given this Promise software by Earl Bryan. Reconosciuto says, in fact, that he and Earl Bryan had paid the Iranians $40 million during the whole surprise October surprise scandal. That's his contention, that he paid. In any event, Reconosciuto, who says that he was a director or research director at the Cabazon Indian Reservation in India, said that Bryan had visited this locale.
Well, and that's Indio, California.
California, right. And in Indio, California. The Cabazon Indian Reservation. Now, he said that Bryan had given him this software and to install, and that a lot of the modifications, most of the modifications, the backdoor modifications, were done on at Indio, California, on the reservation itself. Now, this is significant because the reservation would be pretty much sovereign territory, sovereign land. It wouldn't have federal oversight. In other words, it wouldn't be under the jurisdiction of the federal government.
Mm-hmm. It's essentially a sort of no man's land.
Right. Well, see, with a number of Native American tribes and Native American nations, I should say, basically some of these reservations or some of these tribal areas would be considered sovereign territory. So you wouldn't be applicable. If you're there, you're applicable to tribal laws, not to federal laws or even possibly state laws.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, of course, this is deliberate, right? If Reconosciuto is right, and if he says he installed the backdoor for Promise on the Cabazon Indian Reservation, then
at the Cabazon Reservation in Indio, California, we tie in the private security company formerly known as Wackenhut.
Right.
I think everybody is probably familiar with that name, whether you've seen them as whether it's, you know, the Rent-A-Cop downtown, but it goes much, 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 much higher, and they, like many other shady private, you know, military contractors and such, change their names, and I think they're now known as the Geo Group. So just to keep that straight. And I do have one other thing about Indio, California, unless you have other things that you want to speak about right there.
No. Well, let's hear what let's get into your take.
But it's always interesting to bring in the sort of media, mass media, pop culture connections.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what goes on every spring in Indio, California?
Not off the top of my head.
There is a massive weekend, amazing concert that pretty much has, you know, it's coming up here in actually just a few short weeks in April. It's called Coachella. It's a huge music festival on par with some of the bigger ones around the world. Perhaps the UK does, the Glastonbury Fest or the Reading Festival. Massive, you know, tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of people. I'd love to go to it. It's just too ridiculously expensive, and it has a lot of, basically a lot of the best, you know, kind of new bands in the world.